Northwestern University, in cooperation with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand.
In 18 weeks, Northwestern University moves into its centennial year. 100 years of service to the nation and to the great Northwest. The Reviewing Stand will present many programs of unusual interest. We invite you to listen.
Today, The Reviewing Stand asks, what should I do in an A-bomb attack? Our unrehearsed, give-and-take discussion will center around the danger of an A-bomb attack and the means of defending ourselves against it. And now, our moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, will introduce participants in today's discussion. Mr. McBurney.
Our speakers today are Dr. Earl H. Blair, Chairman of the Committee on Emergency Medical and Surgical Services with the Chicago Civil Defense and the Chicago and Illinois State Medical Societies. Victor C.P. Dreisky, Vice President of the J. Walter Thompson Company and Co-Director of Chicago Civil Defense. Dr. Andrew C. Ivey, Vice President of the University of Illinois and First Vice Chief of the Emergency Medical and Public Health Services with the Chicago Civil Defense. And Colonel Charles T. Tinch, Engineer with the Fifth Army, a man who has seen the damage of the A-bomb at Hiroshima. Now, I should like to open this discussion, gentlemen, by asking whether there is any real reason why we should be concerned about an A-bomb attack. How do you see that, Colonel Tinch?
A year ago, almost to the day, the President of the United States announced that the USSR had succeeded in producing an atomic explosion. It would be mere wishful thinking, therefore, to make any assumption except that the A-bomb is possessed by powers other than ourselves and our allies.
Well, do these powers have the means, Colonel, of delivering such an attack on us?
It is known other powers possess B-29-type aircraft. Operating from their own territory, such aircraft are capable of flying one-way missions against any target in the continental United States. While many would be intercepted and shot down, it is impossible to guarantee 100% interception, particularly at the outset of hostilities.
Dr. Ivey?
Colonel, I believe that it is an element of stupidity to underrate the potential capabilities of a potential enemy. It seemed to me that we must be prepared for any sort of an attack by a potential enemy.
We have a military expression for that, Doctor. We say that we must always base our planning on the other fellow's capabilities rather than his intentions.
Now, these bombs are delivered by aircraft, Colonel. Can you set up a radar screen of some sort that'll give us warning, at least, even though we can't intercept them?
Yes, we can expect early warning, but radar cannot guarantee 100% interception any more than fighter planes can guarantee 100% interception.
Now, don't we know that to be a truth from the experience in World War II? We had the radar screens over in Europe, didn't we?
And a determined attack always got through, at least to some degree.
Well, if these bombs were to be sent our way, would they necessarily come by aircraft, Dr. Ivey?
They could come in by guided missiles. I'd like to hear what the Colonel has to say about that.
Intercontinental guided missiles carrying atomic warheads, I would not say, are an immediate danger. However, seacoast cities must consider the threat of guided missiles launched a comparatively short distance off the coast by enemy submarines.
But isn't it possible that some of our enemies may have something in the way of a guided missile that we don't know anything about now?
That's always a possibility, Doctor.
Could these A-bombs, Dreisky, be brought in here by saboteurs?
Yes, indeed. We just don't have to fear the fact that they might be brought in by airplanes, but they could easily be delivered by freight, or brought in on vessels and ships that might touch our shores and that sort of thing. They also can be assembled here. An A-bomb could be delivered by express or almost any way in pieces, or brought in trucks and then assembled and placed in some area with a timing device that would explode the bomb any time within as long as 6 months.
Do you think that possibility of sabotage is a real factor to be reckoned with?
I think it's as real and as important to reckon with as the dropping of an A-bomb by an airplane. I think it's part of the plan.
Mr. McBurney, I should like to say that Dr. Bundison and Dr. Blair and I were discussing that possibility just this last week in reference to a mobile radio detecting unit that has been made available. And if they take the radioactive materials and bring them in and put them down in a deep cellar, then a detecting apparatus can travel around on the streets and you wouldn't be able to detect it. So we have to be constantly alert against sabotage from that particular source.
Well, I don't mind saying, gentlemen, that in our preliminary discussions of this subject, and in terms of what you're saying now and supposed to say, all of this presents a pretty grim picture. And the question that naturally comes to my mind as a layman is simply this: why haven't we done more about it if this danger is as real as you men seem to think it is? What would you say to that, Dr. Blair?
For the past 3 years, the American Medical Association and the Illinois State Medical Society have been very cognizant of this problem and have done something about it. Upon the explosion of the first atomic bomb, the medical profession individually and collectively saw the potential job they had to do in case this energy were employed in a warlike manner, and began to make plans to alleviate medically.
Yes, Mr. McBurney, the doctors and scientists and many people in the military have been fully cognizant of the potential danger to us from the use of atomic power as a weapon of warfare. But it's been difficult for us to interest lay people in this possibility, and I think that is based upon a fundamental psychological trait of human beings, and that is they don't like to think about the unpleasant or to prepare to prevent the unpleasant from occurring. You know, if you've ever been with a group of soldiers getting ready for combat or getting ready for going over the top, it is always the other soldier that's going to be wounded or going to be a casualty, and it's not yourself. And that represents the natural human tendency to try to avoid thinking about the unpleasant. But here's a situation where we have to work and hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst.
Do you think this A-bomb is as destructive a weapon as the people generally have been led to believe, Dr. Blair?
No, I don't believe so. This is a new weapon in warfare, and naturally a bit of leftist thinking or over emphasis on the destructiveness and the large masses of casualties has followed. I don't believe that, we know that the A-bomb is not as destructive a weapon as we've been led to believe.
Well, just how destructive is it anyway?
Well, I agree with Dr. Blair that in some articles that have been published in magazines, the destructiveness has been overrated. For example, the objective of the Emergency Medical Service and Public Health Group of the Chicago Civil Defense Organization has set up as a definite objective to prevent death among the casualties to the extent of 75%. And I have the cold figures and facts to demonstrate that if we organize the medical services properly, and if the people of Chicago will cooperate, that we can reduce deaths among the casualties by 75%. So a great deal can be done about this.
Having seen Hiroshima, I have a terrific respect for the destructiveness of the atomic bomb. But we must make the point, as you have, Doctor, that had Hiroshima been prepared, a great many of the casualties there might have been saved.
Well, our listeners may or may not know about this Dreyse simulated atom bomb attack on Chicago. But had these three imaginary bombs been dropped on Chicago, what would have been the measure of the casualties and the type of damage done anyway?
Well, we have a great many figures here because when the problem was given to us by the National Security Resources Board, they listed right on the problem the number of casualties we could expect in the dropping of the bombs in the three different locations. We were also given a list of the amount of damage that would be done to the physical side of the thing. That is, the number of stores and buildings and what other destruction might take place. And then we, of course, set out to protect ourselves. And next week we will start telling people what we did as a result of those bombs. To try to give you actual figures at this time regarding the extent of the physical damage would be rather difficult to do. It takes a long list of figures, as I have here, but perhaps Dr. Blair has the number of casualties.
How many casualties would have been involved in that kind of an attack, Doctor?
The two air and the one ground burst would have created a total of 214,000 casualties. That includes the dead. The dead would have numbered 71,000. The subsequent deaths during the following 6 weeks would be approximately 100,000.
Now, are these data given on the assumption that we have made proper precautions?
Yes, exactly. And that's just what I should like to emphasize, that regardless of the enormous number of casualties, we can save the lives of 75% of them by the sort of an organization that we have set up, planned to set up here in Chicago, and to get the people to cooperate with us in this plan through the process of educating them and telling them what to do.
Well, now, before we go into that plan, and I'm interested in it, tell us this, what happens when one of these bombs explodes, Dreisky? What kind of casualties do we get? What kind of damage? What happens?
Well, first of all, within an area of about 1 mile of ground zero, which indicates the exact center of the
bomb. That's where it
bomb. Hits. Yes. Well, that's the ground point of where the bomb, over which the airburst might have occurred. Everything is practically completely destroyed. Beyond that, we have varying degrees of destruction, largely affected by the type of buildings by that I mean whether it's a concrete building or a stone and steel or that sort of thing. Windows, of course, are blown out of buildings to as far away as 5 miles. But there begins the evidence of dissipation of the effect of the bomb.
What are the hazards? Can you tell us more about that, Dr. Blair?
Well, I think when we realize the forces released by the explosion of an atomic bomb, we can get a better picture of it. At ground zero, there's a wind velocity created by this explosion of 800 miles per hour. At 1 mile distance from ground zero, the wind velocity is 200 miles an hour, and still at 2 miles distance, the wind velocity is about 70 mile or hurricane speed. There's a great deal of heat and blast damage and a great deal of damage from flying glass and flash ignition of tinder-like materials. The injuries to the individuals would be about 85% burns and trauma. Then the remaining 15% would be radiation sicknesses.
Yes, and this hypothetical three-bomb attack on Chicago on September the 18th, there were 35,000 cases of radiation disease produced. Now, what can we do about that? This is what we can do. When the individuals come out of the bombed areas who've been exposed to this radiation hazard, they will be studied to see how much radiation they have been exposed to, and then they will be sent to certain refugee centers where a blood count will be made on them every week. And in that way, we can check on the early onset of this disease and give them blood transfusions, and then that way save the lives of many of them.
Well, now, do we have an overall civil defense plan against these tragedies and these emergencies, Dreyfus?
In the Chicago area, we do have such a plan.